Syracuse these days because I've got some responsibilities and I don't permit me to travel. But August is a good time for me to travel because the students are gone. And when the students are gone, the faculty is gone. And there are no students and no faculty, nobody gets a commission but me. And so I can go, I can leave the place. So a week or so ago, I was at my alma mater. I was at Penn State. I'd been there many years. I was there to give a talk. Group about this size in this auditorium like this, and as I was driving from a hotel to the conference center and asking the driver about who's at Penn State now, I realized every member of my doctoral committee is no longer at Penn State. Not only no longer at Penn State, but no longer in this veil of tears, if you know what I mean. They're all gone. So when I got before the group, I asked if anybody remembered Margaret Neuber. Nobody had. Margaret Neuber, 25 years ago, was one of the great professors of mental retardation in the country. Everybody knew Margaret Neuber. And indeed, nobody had remembered, or one person had remembered a couple of the other people on the committee that I had. I got to thinking about that in preparing for today's presentation. And I want to tell you something about the early 1950s, the late 40s and the early 50s, 30 years or so ago when I first came into this field. I was a graduate student at Penn State, and I had been sold and sold myself the bill of goods that handicapped children in general, and mentally retarded children in particular, including the very most mildly mentally retarded, could only get along in segregated special classes. Now, I didn't come to that idea alone. Indeed, that was the prevailing idea in the field, you see. The bastards weren't placing the children in special segregated classes or institutions. The bastards then were placing children in the regular classes, not permitting the handicapped to get that special education service which the retarded and the blind and the deaf and the orthopedically handicapped deserve. My idea. Special education was not unique. And as a matter of fact, there was some good reason for us to push that special education train, that special class train. And the reason had to do with the plain fact that handicapped children were neglected in the regular classes. They were sitting there. So Orville Johnson had done a study of the social position of the mentally retarded in the regular class, the study done at Urbana, Illinois. And he showed that retarded children in the regular classes are accepted less and rejected more than ordinary children. And that only confirmed what May Siegel and a host of other people found. Well, I was in a graduate seminar. To make this story short, I proposed that we ought to just settle the question now that handicapped children should be in special classes, and we don't need to discuss this topic anymore. The professor had a requirement which he insisted upon, and that was, where was the evidence? And so it's everywhere. It's in the literature. That if you place children in special classes, they're going to do better than if you leave them in the regular stream. Well, good. Go to Petit Library. Bring back the references. Let's clear this up. What I thought would be a two-hour experience after some lunch turned out to be 3 weeks, and I still didn't find any evidence. Finally, I found a couple of studies. One by a lady by the name of Annette Bennett, who did her little study in Baltimore, 1932. Another study by a fellow by the name of Frederick Perch, who did his in New York City, 1935. Well, what did they find? They found essentially it didn't make any difference whether children were in special class or in regular class, but if there was any edge at all, it was for the children in the regular class. I'm old about that, and I, somebody else at the time, a fellow by the name of Cowan, figured out that it really was a sampling problem that those two studies caused. And I would design a study which would not so prejudice the assignment of subjects as to get those kinds of findings. Well, it was a sampling problem. Bennett and Perch both looked at kids in special classes, and in order to equalize for socioeconomic background, race, ethnicity, they picked children from the same schools who were in regular grades. And although they had the same IQs as those in the special class, why would one child be in a special class and another child in the regular class? Well, there were differences between the children. And so I designed a study that dealt with that problem. What did I find? Nothing. Didn't make any difference. I got my doctorate out of that experience and made a presentation the next year at the national meeting of AAMD, held in Hartford, Connecticut. Again, indicating to you the kind of field we were, where a national meeting would be held in Hartford, Connecticut. And also indicating what kind of field we were, I was invited to present my findings at this national AAMD meeting in the Grand Ballroom. Because I was one of maybe two dissertations done in the entire country that year in mental retardation. And all I reported, as modestly as I could possibly be, that it didn't make any difference. But of course, it's a doctoral study that was done a total cost of about $35 of traveling around to these schools and giving my own BNA tests and all of the other tests and giving my own achievement tests and using a hand calculator to make all of these comparisons. I encourage people in the field to do some other studies of this type. Well, first, after my presentation, it seemed as if World War III had broken out. How could I say that? Never mind the evidence. Evidence aside, you know that special classes are good for retarded children. There's a little bit of that today. We don't want to hear evidence. Evidence aside, you know that the mainstream is good. I think it's good. I want to believe it's good. But I want us to also study what we're doing and not mindlessly jump on this bandwagon or another one. By the way, just to get closure on those advocacy studies, a flock of them were funded by the Office of Education. There was one big one done right here in Chicago by Mullen and Nipkin for about $1 million. Study after study on the effectiveness of separate classes. We still, to this day, and I include Herb Goldstein's Urbana study in that grouping, we still, to this day, do not have evidence indicating the superiority of special classes, but neither do we have evidence indicating the superiority of the mainstream. The question is open. So how do you make your decisions? You could make them on ethical grounds. You could make them on the basis of what you want for yourselves and for your children. But don't confuse that with science. Now, it's perfectly all right, in my view, to mainstream children purely on the desire of the people. You know, when the slaves were free, they didn't then automatically achieve literacy or even improve their economic station. As a matter of fact, there were many slaves who were economically and otherwise worse off in the decades after the emancipation than before. But the one thing they had after they were free was that they were free. And the purpose of the emancipation was to free them. Not to guarantee that they would read better or earn more money. And the purpose of mainstream is not to guarantee that they're going to learn better in the mainstream or get better jobs after they leave the mainstream, but only that they'll be in the mainstream. And that's a worthy enough goal. It's good enough for some families. It'd be good enough for me to guarantee that my children are going to be in the mainstream. I would like them to read more. I would like them to have better jobs, better positions when they leave. But the purpose of integration, the purpose of mainstreaming and normalization, or whatever you call it, is purely and simply to place people in that large, normal context of the human race. That's the purpose. You shouldn't forget that. Well, gee, I was going to talk about all kinds of other important things that were on my mind. But believe it or not, I got through about a third of the first page of my talk. And it's about 5 minutes to 12, and I'm never going to get through the other 22 pages. You should know what a wonderful lecture you missed, but I just didn't have the time. Well, let me try to end up with some semblance of coherence, if I can. I just finished a study of 14 institutions and other residential places for the mentally retarded. The study will be published as a book by Longman. It'll be out in late September, early October. It's called The Family Papers. We went into these five institutions we had seen about a dozen years ago, which led to that Christmas in Purgatory book. And then into some other institutions and other places that are reputed to be alternatives to the large traditional institution. You might be pleased to learn that those old traditional places look better. They have about half the populations that they once had. That when we once expended $4 or $5 a day per residence, those institutions, we now expend $100 a day sometimes. And we saw one new facility that is spending about $60,000 a year per resident. Places are cleaner. But although everything has changed in the traditional institutions, and surely the alternatives are much better. Camp Hill, large, some of the group homes we'd seen in Tennessee and New York and elsewhere. As a matter of fact, although everything has changed in the large institutions, really nothing has changed of any consequence. That where we once saw large rooms, day rooms of naked patients, naked inmates milling about with nothing to do, we now see the same large rooms, many fewer residents, they're all clothed, they're not naked anymore, but they're still milling about with nothing to do. The thing that strikes us most about the institution is that there's nothing to do there. There's a sort of make-believe life there. Even in the normalized units, go into an institution, you know, my good friend and colleague Wolf Wolfensberger and his mom had been there just a year or so before, charging them up to normalize. Because you go into this unit, there's a rug on the floor, and there's nice furniture, there's a picture on the wall, and everyone is dressed, and the aides are not wearing white uniforms. There's one thing missing. Purpose. The residents sit around, also with nothing to do. There's no purpose. There's no reason. Now, that's one side of the data. The other side, which we don't truly examine in this book because it's in the hunch stage, but I want to share it with you, get you to think about something. I was reminded of this other side, and hence I'm sort of ending with this story, by one of the overheads I'd say this morning, one of the delightful set of presentations. One overhead showed the psychologist, I believe, trying to interest those couple of teachers on Friday afternoon who were asleep. Well, after I got back from the institutions, after doing all of these observations, it took months, I got to thinking about something that became more and more of an important idea in my mind. And that is, suppose those institutions that ennui, that having anything to do, that purposelessness, suppose what I saw there is not the special pathology of institutions for the mentally retarded, but suppose it's but another reflection of a larger culture. Suppose I went into the normal world, what would I see? And so I decided to take some walks around my university campus. And invariably, by Wednesday afternoon, there were the notices tacked up on our bulletin boards. TGIF. Party. And indeed, I walked into one some afternoon to see what these people do. And you see a milling mob getting as quickly sloshed as they can. So that maybe before the weekend is over, they can forget the trials and the terror and the boredom of their previous days and give them some courage to continue on the next week. I also found out that every Friday afternoon, beginning about 2:30 in the afternoon, an enormous parking lot is filled by the city school teachers who all converge on O'Toole's Bar, which is the in bar this year, to all come together and commiserate with each other on the horror of the previous week. Now, there's a lot of that. Now, while we laugh, there seems to be too much of it. There seems to be too much of purposeless behavior and finding ways to forget. I was to a party a few months ago, and I was intrigued by the electric can opener I saw somebody operate. Now, I must admit to you, there is an electric can opener in my house that one day, just unbeknown to me, the bank was giving out this prize if I took something out or put something in. And here I have one of these things, which we've never used. And so I hadn't really seen a real one in action until that evening. And there we are at this party, and this fellow puts in the can, It stands there useless like a bump on a log while that can turns around. Can't even run into the John. Because if he runs into the John while the can is turning, it's going to plop down and splatter all over. So you have to stand there completely useless. A General Electric tells us that progress is their most important product. And they put out egg beaters. Electric egg beaters for Christmas. All over the tube they're announcing electric egg beaters. And on the plane they're having it somewhere, I saw in this issue of the New Yorker magazine a $27 gold toothpick. And I also saw in the Morning Times a $600 pocketbook with the name of the bozo who designs it all over the pocketbook. And then a $53 t-shirt and a $200 cardigan, all with people's names on it. Nobody knows who they are anymore. Louis Vuitton or Yves Saint Laurent or whoever. What the hell is going on? My next door neighbor is a wonderful guy, a very good friend of mine. He gets up in the morning and he jumps on a bicycle for a half hour that goes nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. Then he takes the shower and drives 1 mile to work. And I said, Steve, why don't you take the bike to work? He thinks I come from another planet. Something is going on. There's a uselessness to our lives. We build buildings, we build programs, we build organizations to make people useless. You go into schoolhouses, certainly university buildings, and you can't find a door. You go into a university building these days at anything more than 3 stories, and you've got to use the elevator. There is a stairwell, sure, but it's behind some nondescript door. It's almost as if you're walking into the woman's bathroom and you don't know if it's a woman's room or a man's room or someplace you're not supposed to go into. So nobody uses the staircase. So you have to build all of these elevators. And then you can't open the window. The president says you have to keep the energy at 78 or higher. In some of these places, especially in Syracuse, which is fairly cool, all you needed were windows. You could open up the windows, it could be 72. But you have to keep them closed at 78. And God forbid if the carrier air conditioning goes on the fridge, because then everybody has to evacuate, because it's just impossible to remain in such a building without the air conditioning. Something is going on. There is a flight from reason, from understanding. You know, Thoreau once said that if human beings built their environments as carefully as the birds built theirs, we too would sing like the birds. We don't take care of our bodies. We don't take care of our children. We're not interested in teaching our children anymore. We permitted the schools to say, don't be involved in the education of your children. Let us teach the children. Let me end with one more story, because it is now, I see, 12 o'clock. A few months ago, I was sitting around in the house, reading something, waiting for the 11 o'clock news, wanting to find out again how terribly off we are. And I must have been engrossed in what I was reading, because the news came and went, and I never had a chance to see the news. And as I was about to get up and shut the television off and go to bed, I saw Frankenstein. Was the movie. Well, coincidentally, just a few weeks before, I had read Shelley's book, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I wanted to see what Hollywood was going to do with this great story. And sure enough, Hollywood did not disappoint me. That is, they disappointed me. Mary Shelley wrote a book which depicted what happens to a human being when made lonely. And the moral of the story of her Frankenstein was that if you let a person become lonely, if you do not integrate that person in your ordinary, your normal society, if you shun that person away, if you exclude that person from your society, that person could become a monster. Lonely people become monsters. That was the moral. Now, of course, in order to improve upon her simple idea, Cecil B. DeMille went one or two steps beyond. And his Frankenstein turned out to be, as you all know, far different. The Hollywood message was that there are monsters in the world, and when you catch them, you kill them, or you shunt them out of your society. You banish them. That's what you do with monsters. They have to be banished. You see? When Socrates drank that hemlock, he died, and everyone thinks that the decree he was forced to accept was the capital punishment. But as a matter of fact, Socrates was not given capital punishment. All he had to do was die. Capital punishment in ancient Greece was banishment. It was the highest punishment in the society. Now, you've got a great opportunity these days to prevent capital punishment. And I would think that that's probably the most important job around these days. I want to wish you all a lot of luck. I'm very pleased that you asked me to come here today. I hope that you have a good day today, and I hope you have a good school year. Thank you very much.
Just a little bit over, let's plan to return for a luncheon, after luncheon at 1:30 instead of 1:15 to allow you all to be able to get out and come back comfortable. Okay?
Pat Fisher has a very important announcement, and I think it'll be very topical at this particular time.
Well, Dr. Black, our local chapter of Council for Exceptional Children has a gift. Special educators do it in the least restrictive environment. You can be selling these t-shirts on the at our social that is coming out this afternoon. Should I go on?
Unbelievable.
As president of Chapter 307, I'd like to be the 15th person to welcome you back this morning. And just to urge you to come this afternoon to a social that we are having that will have liquid refreshments at the Chalet Loft, which is south on Wolf Road and 8th Third Street. The other thing I'd like to say is that if you are not a member of CEC and would like to become a member, there will be membership people there with forms for you to fill out. If you are a member but are not a member of 307, there will be forms for you to fill out course, millions of forms, for you to fill out for a change, like if you were a student CEC member when you were in college and you haven't changed, then you can switch it over to 307. The other thing I would like to do is introduce our board, but it'll be really quick. I'll go real fast. The president-elect for this year is Mary Topin. Do you just want to stand? Okay. Secretary is Nancy Christ Bolin. She got married this summer. The treasurer is Carol Murphy. Sports day people are Chris Israelson and Amy Ronan. Legislative, Jean Lee. Membership, Don Miner, Marianne Ovnik, and Ann Casey. Social chair people are the Petersons, Kim and Jeff.